Coming up on the show today, U.S. President Joe Biden planning to visit Israel on Wednesday.
President Biden will underscore our crystal clear message to any actor, state or non-state, trying to take advantage of this crisis to attack Israel. Don't.
Plus, VOA is in Warsaw for Polish election results.
It is a very close race, and as a result, Poland is entering the time of some political turmoil.
And we stroll through the deserted ancient streets in the old city of Jerusalem, and we revisit the Turkish border with Armenia following Azerbaijan's capture of Nagorno-Karabakh. Today is Tuesday, October 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. We start today with a developing story from Israel. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up a 7.5-hour meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the early pre-dawn hours of Tuesday. They agreed on a plan to get much-needed humanitarian aid to Palestinian civilians in Gaza. We'll hear about that in a minute. And they made arrangements for President Biden to visit Israel on Wednesday.
He's coming here at a critical moment for Israel, for the region, and for the world. And he's coming here to do the following. First, the president will reaffirm the United States' solidarity with Israel and our ironclad commitment to its security. President Biden will again make clear, as he's done unequivocally since Hamas's slaughter of more than 1,400 people, including at least 30 Americans, that Israel has the right and indeed the duty to defend its people from Hamas and other terrorists, and to prevent future attacks. The president will hear from Israel what it needs to defend its people as we continue to work with Congress to meet those needs. Second, President Biden will underscore our crystal clear message to any actor, state or non-state, trying to take advantage of this crisis to attack Israel. Don't. To that end, he's deployed two aircraft carrier groups and other military assets to the region. Third, the president will continue to coordinate closely with our Israeli partners to secure the release of hostages taken by Hamas, including men, women, small children, Holocaust survivors, and American citizens, as an indispensable humanitarian effort. Fourth, President Biden will receive a comprehensive brief on Israel's war aims and strategy. Fifth, the president will hear from Israel how it will conduct its operations in a way that minimizes civilian casualties and enables humanitarian assistance to flow to civilians in Gaza in a way that does not benefit Hamas.
The announcement of the plan to distribute humanitarian aid was short on specifics, but did contain a forceful warning.
Today, and at our request, the United States and Israel have agreed to develop a plan that will enable humanitarian aid from donor nations and multilateral organizations to reach civilians in Gaza, and them alone, including the possibility of creating areas to help keep civilians out of harm's way. It is critical that aid begin flowing into Gaza as soon as possible. We share Israel's concern that Hamas may seize or destroy aid entering Gaza or otherwise preventing it from reaching the people who need it. If Hamas in any way blocks humanitarian assistance from reaching civilians, including by seizing the aid itself, we'll be the first to condemn it, and we will work to prevent it from happening again. We welcome the government of Israel's commitment to work on this plan. The president very much looks forward to discussing it further when he's here on Wednesday. Thanks very much.
That's Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Israel on Tuesday. Be sure to follow VOAnews.com for the latest information as it develops. We'll go for a walk in the old city of Jerusalem in a few minutes, but now some more on the diplomatic response to the conflict in Israel. European Union heads of state have scheduled an emergency video conference scheduled for Tuesday afternoon in Brussels. They'll be discussing the worsening conflict between Israeli forces and Hamas militants in Gaza. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the mounting death toll has exposed divisions in the European response.
There are growing fears in Europe that the conflict between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza will be felt beyond the Middle East. The European Union has called an emergency heads of state conference to be held Tuesday. European Council President Charles Michel.
It has the potential to worsen tensions between communities and to feed extremism. Finally, there is a major risk of migration and movements of a large number of people to neighboring countries.
European nations gave Israel their full support in the days following the Hamas attacks. But critics say there has been mixed messaging from EU leaders as the Israeli assault on Gaza intensifies. Visiting the Kfar Aza kibbutz Friday in southern Israel, where Hamas killed dozens of civilians, EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen offered unequivocal support.
Israel has the right to defend itself. In fact, it has the duty to defend its people.
Following that speech, the chair of the European Parliament's Security and Defence Subcommittee, Nathalie Loiseau, wrote that von der Leyen was forgetting an important message. Israel must respect international humanitarian law. Meanwhile, the EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, said last week Israel's siege of Gaza is against international law. The political narrative is becoming more nuanced, says Middle East analyst Andreas Krieg.
I think we're already seeing some of the Western policymakers backtracking and trying to put things into context and saying, while we stand with Israel, we also have to make sure that the lives of Palestinian civilians have to be secured and protected.
That view is echoed in European public opinion, says analyst Andreas Bohm.
They do have solidarity for Israel, I think, due to the nature of the attack. But if you go on a long run, if we see these pictures of, say, thousands or ten thousands of people killed in Gaza, so that might change again.
Israel is unlikely to change course, says Krieg.
And I think the Israelis also will be more resilient in sustaining criticism and sustaining also the leverage of Western policymakers. Because they're saying this is our war, look at these atrocities, and we'll do whatever is necessary to eradicate Hamas.
Meanwhile, the European Union's Executive Commission has announced a tripling of humanitarian assistance to Gaza to $79 million. With Israel maintaining a complete siege of the territory, it isn't clear how or when the aid might reach those in need. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Two Swedish nationals were shot dead and a third wounded in central Brussels on Monday night. A man who identified himself as a member of Islamic State claimed responsibility in a video posted online. The suspected assailant fled the scene after the shooting as a football match between Belgium and Sweden was abandoned at halftime. Russia's foreign minister will visit North Korea this week, the foreign ministry said on Monday. This comes just days after the United States claimed Pyongyang had delivered munitions and military equipment to Russia to use in the fighting in Ukraine. The White House said that more than 1,000 containers of equipment and ammunition had been sent to Russia from North Korea. And a U.S. federal judge in Washington imposed a partial gag order on former President Donald Trump, restricting what he can say about his impending trial on charges that he illegally tried to overturn the 2020 election. The former president is prohibited from speaking publicly about the prosecutors, witnesses, or courtroom staff. Jerusalem's Old City, one of the most visited places in the world, is empty. Since the beginning of the war between Israel and Hamas, tourists and pilgrims have fled, fearing an escalation of violence, especially as Israel prepares for a possible ground war in Gaza. As Jan Boyshat reports from Jerusalem's Old City, shops are closed, churches are empty, and locals avoid leaving their homes.
Just a few days ago, these once bustling streets were teeming with people. But since the war between Hamas and Israel began, the old city of Jerusalem resembles a ghost town. Tourists and pilgrims have fled, fearing the brutal violence of the Gaza Strip and areas around it and the Lebanon border might reach this far. Minder Kalachi owns a shop in the Muslim quarter of the old city.
As you see, it's like a strike. It's a few people going out and in, but there's no tourists, no people coming in. And it's very sad.
Most shops are closed, and the few that are open hardly have any customers. Some merchants say they are coming to work just to avoid staying at home and watching the distressing news about the war. At the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, one of the most visited sites in Jerusalem, very few people attended Sunday Mass. Clerics here say they have never seen the church as empty as it is now. At the Western Wall, only the most observant came to pray. In the Christian quarter, Yahya Atsie says he has been here since before the 1948 creation of the State of Israel, selling souvenirs to tourists and pilgrims. He says that not even during the most violent times has he seen the old city like this.
Not like now. This is the first time I saw it very empty. Because it's a big war in Gaza.
In the first 9 months of 2023, nearly 2.7 million tourists visit here. Now, shop owners wonder when the visitors will be back. Yambuesha, VOA News, Jerusalem.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. Still to come on the show, does your investment portfolio include comic books? Well, perhaps it should. Plus, a visit to the Turkish border with Armenia. Now, though, we go to Poland, where voters have turned out in some of the greatest numbers seen in the country's elections to cast their ballots. PiS, or the Law and Justice Party, is ahead in the polls, but does not yet have a clear majority needed to form a government. Opposition parties promised to repair the nation's constitutional order and its relationship with allies, including the EU and Ukraine. However, it's uncertain if there will be a clear winner. VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Mirosława Gongadze is in Warsaw.
The governing coalition, right-wing Law and Justice Party, that has been in power for 8 years, got, according to the exit polls, most of the votes on Sunday. However, they have been in power for 8 years, and many people I talk to at the voting stations and many people, just residents of Warsaw and other cities, said that they had enough of this coalition. So basically, what polls showed this election, that they do want change. An Ipsos exit poll published early this Monday gives PiS 36.6% of the vote, which would translate into 198 lawmakers in the 460-seat parliament. Opposition parties led by the former European Council President Donald Tusk's civil coalition are projected to win combined 248 seats. Again, it's a 50% of the voting have been counted. However, as we predicted, it is a very close race, and as a result, Poland is entering the time of some political turmoil.
The opposition leader, Donald Tusk, is already declaring the beginning of a new era for Poland. So what are the implications of this new era?
I would not talk about new era yet, because this will be a longer process than maybe you Polish voters or even outside observers want. If President Duda will let Law and Justice Party to try to form the coalition and then their government, he has a right to do that, because the Law and Justice Party won majority of the votes. However, the experts say it is almost impossible for them to be able to form that coalition. So that means that the parliament opposition coalition will get the second try at the forming the government, and then President Duda could also decline to ask Law and Justice to try to form the government, given the parliamentary mass. So this is like a very, very difficult process. If the second parliamentary attempt fails, then President Duda will select another candidate for PM. And if that will fail, he can call a fresh election. So if all these stages pan out, Poland could be without a government into November and December, or heading toward the fresh election.
That's VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Mirosława Gongadze in Warsaw. She was speaking with my colleague Kim Lewis. Comic books are anything but funny to some investors. That story's up next. Now, Azerbaijan's recapture of the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave from ethnic Armenians could mean that Turkey will soon reopen its border with Armenia after more than 30 years. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkey closed its border with Armenia in 1993 after ethnic Armenians seized a disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave from Turkey's close ally, Azerbaijan. After Azerbaijani forces last month recaptured the enclave, some analysts say there is an opportunity to end Turkey's embargo that has damaged Armenia's economy and forced it to rely on neighboring Russia. Hussein Baja is the head of the Foreign Policy Institute, a research organization in Ankara.
Turkey can play a very constructive role for the economic development of Armenia. The Armenians have to make a choice between poverty and prosperity. The more confrontation means more poverty. The more engagement means prosperity.
In a sign of improving relations, Ankara opened its border to allow Armenian aid after February's deadly earthquakes in Turkey. And Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan attended Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's inauguration after his May election victory. To reopen the Armenian border, Ankara is demanding Yerevan recognize the Turkish border and a peace agreement between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Some analysts say Yerevan is ready for a deal as it seeks to break away from Russia's influence, and having the war out of the way is a big step. Eric Hachopian is a political consultant in Armenia.
The economy is moving in the right direction. The Western pivot is moving in the right direction. Democratization is moving in the right direction. And everything that's the only thing that's interfering with that is the threat of war. So you take away the threat of war, all of this becomes easier. The economic acceleration continues.
But an opportunity for a peace deal between Azerbaijan and Armenia, brokered by the European Union, this month fell victim, some observers say, to diplomatic infighting between EU leaders and Turkey. Soli Ozel is an international relations professor at Kardahas University.
Azeris said that Turkey ought to be in the talks. The Germans and the French said Turkey cannot be in the talks, and you really wonder which world they're living in. I would have expected that the Europeans, particularly the French, would work with Turkey and get Armenia out of the orbit of Russia.
Observers say Russian President Vladimir Putin was quick to seize the opportunity to bring Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev closer to his influence, inviting him to a regional summit in Kyrgyzstan, where Putin offered a broker a peace deal, an offer rejected by Yerevan. Russian expert Tatiana Mitrova is a visiting professor at the Paris School of International Relations.
Russia was always playing on these contradictions and mutual dissatisfaction, and it was a typical divide and rule policy starting from Tsarist Russia, not even Soviet Union. So it has very, very long historic roots. My impression is that these days Moscow would do everything to create instability everywhere.
Azerbaijan's recapture of the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave may lead to the reopening of Turkey's border with Armenia after three decades. But observers warn Moscow could yet undermine those efforts after the failure of the European Union to broker a peace deal between Baku and Yerevan. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
And finally today, would you pay $1 million for a comic book? Well, neither would I. Since 2006, comic book fans have gathered at the legendary New York City Comic Con to dress up and shop. And more recently, they've gathered to invest. Aaron Rainin has the story from New York.
More than 200,000 avid comic book enthusiasts, adorned in their beloved comic character costumes, descended upon New York City's Javits Center over the weekend to partake in the New York City Comic Con. Yuki Chrissy is a Comic Con attendee.
I love Comic Con because I like like to see all the like cool exclusives and cosplays, everything. It's just like, it's experience.
As the spotlight shines brightly on costumes and the vast array of innovative new comics, older treasures like vintage comic books have also made their grand entrance, boasting price tags that climb into the millions. Vincent Zerzolo is president of Comic Connect.
When you go to Comic-Con, you're going to see all the flash and the glitz, all the cosplayers, the Hollywood stars. But at its core, at its heart, it's all about vintage comic books. You're going to see rows of books worth millions of dollars.
Zerzolo says certain books are worth more than diamonds.
This one right here is by Bob Kane from DC Comics from 1939. It's the first appearance of Batman ever in a comic book. This comic book in this condition is worth approximately $400,000. This is Marvel Comics number one. This copy is one of the best copies known to exist in the world, and this comic book is worth $3 million.
In 2022, Heritage, the nation's leading comic art auction house, reported sales exceeding $195 million, a 7% increase from the previous year.
Comic books fit into some people's investment portfolios. They're looking for alternative forms of investment outside of stocks and bonds and precious metals. They're looking for something they're also passionate about, and they're passionate about comic books.
Online retailers have taken notice of this market, with eBay establishing a significant presence at Comic-Con. Whether you're a buyer or a seller, the incredible crowd at this year's Comic-Con solidifies that the love for comic art is rock solid. And who knows, that comic book you buy today may be worth a jackpot in the future. Aaron Rainin, VOA News, New York City.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gender equality is one of the United Nations' 17 Sustainable Development Goals, set forth in 2015 and intended to be reached by 2030. Yet with little more than 6 years to go, progress is slow. Today, women stand at the head of only 28 countries and represent 1 in 4 members of parliament. According to UN Women, at this pace, the world will reach gender parity in another 130 years. The gender gap in power and leadership remains entrenched. Gender-based violence, including technology-facilitated gender-based violence, is increasing, and discrimination remains commonplace, said United States Permanent Representative to the UN's Economic and Social Council, Lisa Carty.
Those who stand in the way of the advancement of women and girls also reduce the prosperity and security of all persons, especially vulnerable groups. They erode the full potential of the democratic way of life. They undermine the achievement of the Sustainable Development Goals and the 2030 Agenda, and they make way for the unyielding grip of authoritarianism.
On the other hand, those who stand with women and girls create a space for the promotion and protection of human rights and fundamental freedoms for all persons, regardless of gender, said Ambassador Carty.
As we focus on the advancement of women and girls in our societies, our nations, and our world, we see a clear connection between the treatment of women and girls and the well-being of all people. The evidence is clear. When women and girls are denied the full enjoyment of their human rights, all of society is harmed.
With that in mind, on the one-year anniversary of Mahsa Amini's death, President Biden reaffirmed our commitment to the courageous people of Iran, who are carrying on the historic Woman Life Freedom Movement she inspired, said Ambassador Carty.
We applaud the bravery and sacrifice of so many who have stood up in the face of oppression and violence to fight for not just gender equality, but also broader fundamental freedoms, which Iran's government has denied to women.
Human rights apply to all individuals, all of the time, everywhere, said Ambassador Carty. We therefore question why anyone would seek to deny half the global population the full enjoyment of their human rights. Societies function best when all persons are included and recognized as equals. Global challenges can only be solved when women and girls in all their diversity have a seat at the table.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.